Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. One thing about Little Richard is that he recorded his old hits many, many times over. It seems like every time he would, you know, get signed to a new record deal, first order of business, re-record all the old hits in a much worse fashion. And we're hearing an instrumental version of one of those now. Author Mark Grabowski is our guest today. His book, The Big Life of Little Richard, I found it quite interesting. You know, one of those guys you know a decent amount about, and of course there's so much more complexity to his life and his personality. So, interesting read. We'll talk to Mark Grabowski in a minute. I just want to remind you that we are in the middle of our October fundraiser. It's a great time to sort of support WFMU. If you are a podcast listener and you enjoy the website, the archives, I urge you to head to WFMU.org/Michael. Click on the banner. You can support us with a monthly pledge. A lot of folks do that. You get an extra shirt if you do that at the $10 a month level, or just pledge $10 or $1 million, whatever you can afford, a one-time pledge. It's the last chance to get the Michael Shelley set of four coasters. They're awesome. Get a t-shirt, a sticker, just support FMU. We need it. We spend it efficiently. And, of course, I'm not paid. None of the DJs are paid. But this still costs a small fortune just to keep the lights on and the internet running, etc. So consider that if you are a user supporter of WFMU. All right, let's get back to it. Mark Grabowski, author of The Big Life of Little Richard. Here he is. All right, there is Little Richard, and Mark Grabowski joins us on the telephone. He is the author, as I've been saying, of this brand new book called The Big Life of Little Richard. Mark, good morning, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing all right. So Little Richard died in May, age 87. Were you already at work on the book?
Yeah, that's a whole other story. We originally intended to make it like a tribute book, like a coffee table, you know, a lot of pictures, oversized book. One of those glossy things with limited text. And that changed the day he died, because it wasn't relevant the other way anymore. So I had to rearrange it as a biography, which was okay with me, because there had never really been a good, solid biography of Little Richard.
Yeah, that's quite interesting to hear, because, yeah, you're reading that, you would never think that's how it came to be. You know, there was a lot of surprises in the book for me, and one of the things I was most surprised about, I didn't really realize how much recording he had done before the breakthrough specialty sessions. What do you think was missing in those recordings? Why didn't they connect?
The early ones were fascinating, because you got to hear Little Richard before he was Little Richard. I mean, he was Little Richard on the road. He had been performing in the Deep South and Georgia and Tennessee and, you know, Florida and all those areas. And he was a wild man. He performed in a lot of the early gay clubs, which were like on the underground R&B circuit, where you dressed up in drag, and it was like a weird thing. And then he got this contract with RCA, and all of a sudden he was put in the studio with these seasoned musicians, and they told him to be an R&B guy. You know, they wanted him to be like a traditional R&B singer. So when you listen to those old songs, you would never know it's him, because he sounds older. He sang slower. There was none of the jump and bop and, you know, and craziness of Little Richard. But even so, if you as I did, dissect those early songs, like there was a song called Get Rich Quick, which if you listen to it, there's a sax solo by Albert Dobbins on that prefigures rock and roll perfectly. It's like, and it's also like a proto rock and roll funk kind of song. So you knew he had that in him, but he needed a much better producer and a much better label for him, which was Specialty.
Yeah, it's very interesting. His dad kicked him out of the house. He dropped out of high school. He washed dishes at the Greyhound bus station, did all this weird touring, was in minstrel shows. But I sort of get this idea that, like, when the day he was born, he came out of the womb and sort of went, woo, you know, and had the hair and was wearing a suit, you know. But obviously that what you say, the character who was Little Richard on stage, develop? Was he, I mean, clearly he's an unusual guy, but how did, you know, what, can you put your finger on what made him decide, I don't care, I've got to be me?
Well, he was always trouble. When he came out, he was trouble, which is why his father never dug him. I mean, you know, his father kicked him out of the house when he was a teenager because he dressed effeminately, put on his mother's makeup. You know, he was something that you didn't expect to see in the 1940s. You know, you didn't expect in that era of time, you didn't expect that so openly from a young man like that.
Where did he get the courage to be so out?
It's just the way he was, and you know, some people are just born that way. And the thing was, down there in Macon, he there was a whole scene that he could partake of at that age. There was a, you know, in the downtown clubs, several of those were like you know, underground gay kind of clubs, and kind of a new R&B where you would go woo, like, you know, you wouldn't adhere to the old formulas. And he was taken in by a couple who owned a club downtown called a TikTok Club. It's a very, very famous club. Later on became even much more famous. And they kind of took care of him and let him go on stage and do his thing as a young man, you know, 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 12-year-old. So he fell into this scene. And as you said, that caused a lot of problems with his father, Charles Bud Penniman, who also owned the club downtown, but refused to play that kind of music. He played the old style R&B, you know, Andrew Sisters, Bing Crosby, you know, that kind of swing music, the Mills Brothers. So he threw Richard out, but Richard was able to to assimilate this kind of music at the other clubs, and he was really ready to go at 15, 16. He just couldn't find the right outlet yet.
It's interesting because, yeah, he was 23 when Tutti Frutti was a huge hit. Do you think, because there's a lot in the book about this, that, you know, because he had toured a lot and had his own band who were, by all descriptions, pretty amazing live, but yet they used these amazing New Orleans studio guys to record Richard. Do you think that, in retrospect, was a good call?
I think that probably saved his career. And if you look at it in a broader picture, probably saved rock and roll. Because, you know, had he used his own band, which were great, like you say, the Upsetters were a very, very good band, and they were able to succeed on their own later on when Richard kind of left them. But for the studio sessions, it's specialty. Art Roop, the owner of the label, and Bumps Blackwell, his A&R man and producer, knew what they wanted from Richard because they had heard his tapes and they heard something unique and, you know, something special that they had never heard before. But they wanted to pair him with the rock, with the New Orleans rock musicians, the blues guys who had recorded with Fats Domino and Lloyd Price, you know, Smiley Lewis. They knew what they wanted. Richard almost boycotted the first session for Specialty because he was so set on having the Upsetters do the music. But he was persuaded, and what you got out of that first session was Tutti Frutti, which was a whole story in itself how that came about, because that wasn't part of the original set list. And that happened when Bumps Blackwell was so dissatisfied with the session that he just cut it short and said, let's go out and have some drinks. They went to the Dew Drop Inn down the street. Richard just, without any provoking, got up on stage and started doing Tutti Frutti, which was a song he had been doing on the road. Very dirty, very unacceptable lyrics about a good booty, quote unquote, and all the other, you know, you can grease it if you need to, those kind of lyrics. So Blackwell heard the right song, it just had the wrong lyrics. He had to call in another songwriter to clean up the lyrics. But it all worked. This is how history is made, and these little crazy asides. And after the new lyrics came in, they recorded it, and bingo, you had Little Richard and a new rock and roll.
The first period for Richard, when he had, you know, all the songs pretty much that he's remembered for, about 1955 to 1958, how famous was he? How big was he?
Oh man, he was so famous that when he toured with his band, the Upsetters, throughout the South, he didn't have to go stay in a black-only hotel. He didn't have to eat at a black-only restaurant. He was like a king. He could have the best rooms, the best food, the best women, I mean, and men, we don't even, that's a whole other subject in the book, like which he favored throughout his life. That's a whole other story, psychologically, you know. But he was a king, and he was like the first black rocker to be in the movies. When the movies discovered the potential in rock and roll to attract young audiences, Little Richard was the first black one to really get a call. Fats Domino had been in a couple of them, you know, but Little Richard really lit the flame. And he was in like four of those movies, you know, including a regular feature, which She's Got to Have It, with Jane Mansfield, you know, which is like he was almost like a co-star. He was so popular.
One of the things that I guess I knew it, but when you sort of read it in a book, it becomes so much more plain that how short that initial period was. You know, after that long road to get there, just, you know, less than 3 years later, he's on a plane headed to Australia, and he thinks he sees a sign from God that he needs to quit rock and roll, sing gospel, join the ministry. And he does go to Bible school, which is kind of a short-lived, didn't work out at all, did not go well for Richard. There's also a suggestion that the whole leaving showbiz thing was just a ruse to get out of his terrible contract at Specialty. What do you think?
Yeah. It was, but, you know, I mean, he did have these internal wars that he was always fighting due to the relationship with his father, who was murdered, actually, outside of that bar I mentioned before.
Yeah.
When Richard was actually getting back closer to him. There was a lot going on in Richard's mind that really needed professional help, but there was no such thing back then. And you're right about how short a period of time this was. Consider this, out of his first releases, three of the first five records that he released had number one R&B songs on both sides of the record on three of those, and in addition to Tutti Frutti. So from mid to late 55 through 1956, he could do no wrong. That's what makes that sabbatical so bizarre.
Yeah.
And it was only one of like two or three of those religious retreats. Yeah, he thought when Sputnik went up, the Russian satellite, that it was a sign that the world was coming to an end. And he was on tour in Australia and just walked off the tour, threw his rings and watches into the river and came back home. But as you say, he never completely fell out of the rock fold. And it was a matter of getting more royalty, a better royalty rate. But he never could, and he had to settle for, get this, $11,000 after he sued Art Rupe for his back royalties. He settled for $11,000, and that really killed him later on. In fact, it was only through the largesse of Michael Jackson that he ever made any money. Which is, you know, when Michael Jackson bought the Beatles catalog, he realized that it was more than just the Beatles. There was also Little Richard songs in that catalog. And he knew Little Richard as a devotee of Little Richard. He knew how much Little Richard had been ripped off. And so he gave Little Richard, out of his pocket, basically $4 million. That allowed Richard basically to die in peace. So that's how long it took for him to get any really kind of money. But he did live high on the hog, because from what he got from even 5 cents a record was amazing for those years in the 50s. And they kept perpetuating years after.
Yeah, the book definitely tells the story of how he liked to spend money and how he took care of his friends and family. And it's kind of interesting. I want to remind folks that Mark Hrabowski is our guest, and his brand new book is called The Big Life of Little Richard. One of the things, you know, We've touched on it a bunch of times, it was Richard's sexuality. He was married to this lady named Ernestine, who said if he was gay, he was very good about hiding it from me. But it's kind of clear that sort of that link between what you were talking about earlier, the over-the-topness of the style in the gay clubs, is central to that Little Richard character and to kind of pushing that over-the-topness that's all about him, that's in the music and in the energy. It's all right there. It's just... is that the issue that just ate at him over the years?
Yeah, you got to remember he was thinking on a business level at the same time he was thinking on a musical level, which was kind of very rare for its time. This requires a lot of thought, as I tried to do in the book, because he was much more complicated than people ever realized, which was by his design. He didn't want to be thought of as complicated. He wanted to be thought of as the best rocker in the world who, you know, could get anybody's feet moving to dance. But this whole thing with his sexuality is very complicated. He insisted he was gay up until the last years of his life, when he turned on the gay lifestyle very cruelly, very harshly. But for most of his career, he wanted people to think he was gay. And I think it was because he wanted nobody to delve into what he was really thinking. He wanted to keep that whole area out of the public view. He didn't want it to complicate what he was doing on stage. And you got to say, he was right, because all through his years, even in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when gayness actually was no longer a crutch to bear, he still adhered to that same personality and got a whole new audience because of it. So it came out right for him, but I don't think inside he ever reconciled who he was, and that was part of the problem.
Yeah, it's certainly really, really complicated. I was watching this week some clips of Richard on, like, Dave Letterman from these times when he's wearing a suit and tie and his hair is just very normal. And, you know, yeah, it's very, very complicated. So he comes out of this first I'm quitting show business period in the early mid-60s, and he tours with Sam Cooke, and he tours the UK and Germany. And it's kind of like you hear this story over and over in early rock and roll. A lot of those guys were kind of being ignored in the US, but in Europe they were these gods almost. And of course Richard ate that up. You know, that was so perfect for him. You know, and it's, even though his songs were less than 10 years old, he was a god. I assume, you know, he loved that.
Richard was so popular in England that he actually was the case can be made, okay, let's put it that way. The case can be made that he flipped on the light switch for the Beatles, because he toured with them. They begged to tour with him. Brian Epstein begged Little Richard to put the Beatles, you know, on first. It was all Little Richard who drew the crowds. And he never let anybody forget that, even after the Beatles became the Beatles. You know, he never forgot that. But they weren't the only ones. You know, Mick Jagger used to sit on the front of the stage when Richard toured England and just idolize, you know, make mental notes. He idolized the guy. Elton John did that later on. You know, he was such an inspiration, which is why he stayed in rock and roll. The money was just too much. First from Europe, and then he trickled back to America, and he became a whole new Little Richard, you know, a funky Little Richard, you know, an Earth, Wind, and Fire kind of looking Little Richard. But he recorded an amazing amount of records, some with Jimi Hendrix, some with Billy Preston. You know, these were like, you know, big sessions. I think he recorded for every label in America. You know, I don't think there was one that got by him.
He loved to complain, and again, it's hard to know what is the Little Richard character and what is heartfelt. But was he bitter? Was he bitter about all this, or did he feel lucky?
He was very bitter, but you know, he never showed it publicly. He was very, very, very bitter about the money, and he had every right to be, because, I mean, he sued Art Rupe later on, after Rupe had sold Specialty Records. He sued him and lost. He was held to that $11,000 deal that he made in 1959. But, I mean, he never could. He lived high, but it was not high enough for him, because he would look around the business and see these young R&B people in the 70s. He's saying, boy, you know, that was me. That was me years ago. I could do a song like that, but they just never let me, and they never paid me for what I did. So he was very bitter. And again, if it wasn't for Michael Jackson coming to his aid, I don't know how he would have been able to spend his final years, because he never had any money. So he had a right to be bitter, but he lived his life publicly the way his fans wanted him to be. They wanted him to be the happy-go-lucky guy from the 50s. That was his ilk. That was how he succeeded. That's all they really wanted from him. And he was always Little Richard to the end.
Mark Hrabowski, the book is called The Big Life of Little Richard. I really enjoyed it, and I wish you luck with it. And, you know, it, of course, made me go back and, you know, all week I've been listening to those records, and they're just fantastic, you know, the records. Those are the best. Let's hear from Little Richard. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well,
appreciate
it. and I just got paid. Fool about my money, don't try to save. My heart say go, go, have a time, cause it's Saturday night. Now I'm feeling fine, I'm gonna rock it up. Tonight.